Hi, this is Mark Steiner. Before we listen to this segment, there's one note. Due to technical difficulties, we lost the beginning of our segment analyzing the DeCamp v. United States Supreme Court decision, a very technical decision that is opening the door for reducing sentences for some violent offenders, known during the Reagan era as career criminals. Over the course of this segment, you'll hear from Judge Andre Davis, Senior Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Fourth Circuit, Mary Price, General Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and Sujit Raman, Appellate Chief for the Maryland U.S. Attorney's Office. And here's Sujit Raman talking about one of the challenges this case presents for law enforcement.
It's really amazing that if you shoot somebody and if you are convicted of second-degree assault, if you come up later in the federal system because you possessed a gun, that prior conviction will not count as a prior violent conviction. And it's the same with rape, by the way. Second-degree rape, and Mr. Crockett is one of the individuals who's mentioned in, I know Judge Davis was originally the judge who sentenced him. Mr. Crockett raped an 11-year-old child, and categorically going forward, that act does not qualify as a violent crime. So I don't want to go on and on, Mark, but that is part of the challenge that I think on the law enforcement side that we're facing, that individuals who indisputably committed what I think regular people would think are violent acts are not being held accountable under the recidivist statutes, the repeat offender statutes. And again, we're talking about a very small category of people.
Mary Price, go ahead. I want to hear what you, I hear you're trying to break in. Go ahead.
Well, I certainly agree that people who are convicted of violent conduct ought to be punished for their crimes. And as I understand it, all of the people who are at issue in these cases did serve time for their violent offenses in Maryland. The problem, it appears to me, is that the Maryland statute itself doesn't agree with that assessment. In other words, the Maryland statute reaches all kinds of different conduct, not just violent conduct, but also conduct that's not considered violent by federal law. The problem appears to be the Maryland statute, and it seems that some energy might go to addressing whether or not the Maryland second-degree assault statute ought to be looked at. When we're looking at mandatory minimum sentences, and these are cases where judges are completely taken out of the picture in terms of determining, once a conviction has been reached, determining what the appropriate sentence is, judges may, in some cases, think that the 15-year mandatory minimum is appropriate, but many times it's not. And unfortunately, we have to be very, very vigilant, certainly at the federal level, about what kinds of offenses count when triggering a 15-year mandatory minimum. And I think that the extra vigilance does have its cost sometimes, but I think in this case it's appropriate, and certainly the Supreme Court thought so.
So this is where it gets confusing to me, Andre Davis, and I think it gets confusing to our listeners. What this, I mean, actually means. I mean, there's the issue of mandatory minimum sentences. The man who may be our next Attorney General is against mandatory minimum sentences, as we debated on the show about. But he was attacked for that because he on the air by many people. But that's A. Does that help or hinder our justice system? What is it meant for our justice system? And the reality of also what Sujit Raman was talking about, which is the question of what how you apply things like second-degree assault for rape and shooting. And but that's also a broad category. It can be second-degree assault. Could be if I came over and knocked you down on the ground. Could be in a fight could be second-degree assault.
That's
right?
Exactly right, Mark. And mandatory
not that I would or want to or could even.
Mandatory minimums. Federal statutes creating mandatory minimums are grossly over-inclusive. It sweeps up people who don't belong in that category. And Sujit is quite right in his description of the challenge faced by prosecutors. But if you heard what he said, think about it for a second. If somebody shoots somebody in Maryland, they shouldn't be convicted of second-degree assault. They should be convicted of attempted murder or first-degree assault or something that clearly under the federal statute would qualify them for harsher treatment. The problem, frankly, and this you got to get into the weeds a little bit to really see this, the problem is that at the state level, plea bargaining permits admittedly some violent offenders to walk away with convictions that are not violent convictions. Not every serious crime is a violent crime. And Congress used the word violent. And so what the Supreme Court has done in Discamps and in earlier cases like Taylor and Shepard is they take this somewhat over-inclusive approach to criminal punishment, and they wisely said, well, surely Congress couldn't have intended for someone who shoves somebody, which is a second-degree assault in Maryland, to get a mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years later on. And Justice Kennedy, by the way, makes this point in the Discamps opinion. He wrote a separate opinion in which he points out that when people plead guilty to crimes in state court, they don't pay a lot of attention to the particular facts that are going into the conviction. And he identified that as one of the bases.
They, the defendants, you mean? Who's the they?
The defendants who plead guilty. Uh-huh. They're not thinking about what's going to happen down the road if and when they are charged with a federal crime. And Justice Kennedy, who's long been an opponent of mandatory minimums. Remember, when I was here before, I mentioned the Justice Kennedy Commission from 2003. Justice Kennedy actually permitted this group to use his name to do some evaluation of criminal justice issues. And one of the things that he talked about and that the commission talked about was the lack of wisdom, by and large, in mandatory minimums. What Sujeet mentioned, and I'll stop in a moment, judges forever have been able to look at the background characteristics and behavior as well as the prior convictions of persons who come before them for sentencing in federal court. And so there is nothing to prevent, really nothing to prevent a judge from imposing a 15-year sentence on someone that the judge believes really deserves that, up to the statutory maximum. We don't need mandatory minimums to treat this problem. Judges, I think, have the capacity, the wisdom, the insight, and the courage, frankly, to do what needs to be done without the mandate of a federal statute.
So before I return to Mary Price, let me come back to Sujeet for a moment. Sujeet Raman from the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, this is the complexity of it. I mean, when you hear what Judge Andre Davis was just saying about the mandatory minimums can be dangerous, and you need to have some judicial wisdom prevail here when it comes to cases. Because when you just outlined, Sujeet, it was like including all these secondary assaults that could be anything. And you also included drug offenses, and isn't part of the problem in America's prisons today that we have millions of people who have been locked up and arrested for nonviolent drug offenses and maybe in federal prison because they've had three of them, whether selling marijuana or selling heroin or whatever that is, but not necessarily violent offenses, and they're put away as well. I mean, isn't that where the problem rests, and shouldn't be wrestling with it from that end to kind of change the way we actually sentence people and even arrest people?
Well, Mark, you raised some very interesting points, obviously, as does Judge Davis and Mary as well. I would say just focusing on the DeCamp opinion, it doesn't really have too many implications for nonviolent offenders or some of the drug offenses that you mentioned. And so I think we can put that issue to the side. I do think the Department of Justice has had some recent initiatives relating to nonviolent drug offenders and other individuals like that, which we can talk about, sort of separately. But just focusing on the violent crime issue, and I think Judge Davis is very right to point out that there often is a plea negotiation process that goes on not only in state court, but also in federal court. And I think that's one of the issues that we often overlook in this discussion, is that often when we, on the federal side, plead out a defendant, say, to a gun possession charge, which comes with, say, a mandatory 15 years, that is actually a good deal for the defendant because he might have actually possessed his gun in furtherance of a violent crime, which under federal law comes with a whole set of additional mandatory penalties, 7-year mandatory consecutive terms of imprisonment, all of which we often negotiate away in return for the certainty that this repeat violent offender will serve at least 15 years in federal prison. And so part of the implications of a decision like DeCamp is that it really is a one-way ratchet. There is a benefit to the defendants who are now found that, their prior convictions no longer qualify as violent felonies, even though if you look at the actual facts of the case, the person assaulted somebody violently or shot them or raped them. But the flip side of it is, the federal government isn't able to bring back the additional charges that we bargained away. And as Judge Davis rightly points out, plea bargaining is a very important part of the criminal justice system, both on the state side and the federal side. I would, you know, respectfully resist the idea that defendants plead guilty without really knowing what they're doing. I mean, I think certainly everybody has a right to counsel, certainly in felony cases, and I think competent defense lawyers will ensure that their clients aren't pleading guilty just to plead guilty. In other words, the system will not work if people are not knowingly and voluntarily pleading guilty to the crimes that they've committed. And often when you look at these plea colloquies, they do sometimes have the problems that Judge Davis has pointed out. And, of course, Judge Davis has very long experience on the state side as well as on the federal side. But I will say sometimes you look at the documents and it's very clear that the person did exactly what they said they did, which is commit a violent crime. And again, the deeper issue for us and on the law enforcement piece of it is that these crimes categorically do not qualify as violent crimes going forward. And I mean, that is tremendously impactful on our ability to do our jobs. You know, that,
so Mark, just to put this in context, if I may, very quickly.
And then we get back to Mary.
Sure. Sujeet's absolutely right. But what needs to be borne in mind, of course, is that there is a constitutional backdrop to these decisions, and in particular the camps, the basic constitutional notion here is that any punishment a person receives for a criminal offense must be driven by a finding by a jury. As we all know, in our system, as a first principle, we believe in jury trial. It's right there in the Constitution, not just in the amendment, but in actual Article 3 of the Constitution. The founder said criminal trial shall be by jury. Now, a defendant can waive a jury trial if he or she chooses. So what the court has been confronted with in these cases is, to what extent do we permit judges rather than juries of the defendant's peers decide the facts necessary to determine what level of punishment the defendant should get. And so that's what's behind this. So this is as complicated as it is. At bottom, it's really a response to our constitutional structure.
Mary, what were you about to say?
Mary, well, Price. I mean, I absolutely agree. And I wanted to go back to something that Suji brought out about plea bargaining, all of which he describes exactly what goes on. But one of the things that he said was, you know, that 15-year mandatory minimum, that's a good deal. And what this discussion and what our sort of understanding of how the system works sort of hides a little bit is how distorted our criminal justice system has become with the use of mandatory minimums. Discretion at sentencing has to reside somewhere. And what mandatory minimums have done is that they have shifted the discretion that judges would normally have over whether or not a person deserves that mandatory minimum of 15 years or not, and shifted it over to the prosecutor, who can, behind closed doors, out of the public view, negotiate with a defendant and say, look, you know, if you accept this set of facts and agree to them that you did, we will drop these charges. If you go to trial, however, we will bring more charges. And we see this over and over and over again. It's called the trial penalty, and it's come under a great deal of criticism lately because of the exceptional sentences that people will get if they decide to exercise their constitutional rights to go to trial. Now, I'm not criticizing Suji's practice. I don't know how your office works, and I'm not I don't mean to disparage that, but wouldn't it be better to have a system where, you know, a judge then looks at the facts that have been established by the plea or by the jury conviction and determine what the appropriate sentence is? In the system that you have laid out for us, there is this unseemly process that goes on that it can't really be reviewed in any real effective way, and certainly not by the public, which results in a mandatory minimum sentence that can't be changed.
Mary, you make a very powerful point, and Sujeet's office is one of the best in the country.
I know.
Of course, but your point is very powerful, and I'm glad you shared it.
So I have to take a break here. I'm going to get our listeners to join us at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts. Maybe you or your family members have been involved in this. Maybe you have knowledge of this as an attorney. You care about our criminal justice system. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. And I'm going to talk about what we think now this leads to in terms of is there a change happening in our criminal justice system, and why? 410-319-8888. You're hearing Billie Holiday under me as we go out. The way you the way you look tonight, it was written by Dorothy Fields, who was born on this day in 1905, the first woman to be selected into the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
With each word, your tenderness grows, tearing my fear apart.
Can't keep his mind on nothing else. He changed the world for a good thing he's found. If she is bad, he can see it. She can do no wrong. Turn his back on his best friend if he put her down. When a man loves a woman.
One of the great songs of all time, this Percy Sledge, When a Man Loves a Woman. In 1966, this song went gold on this day, as it well should have. Percy Sledge. So back from our day in history and music on day in history, and back to our guest here. Mary Price is General Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Sujit Raman, is Appellate Chief for the Maryland U.S. Attorney's Office. Judge Andre Davis is Senior Judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit also made a decision around this case of Enriquez, which is a man who was convicted of burglary and used an old burglary case, and also saying it was a violent crime, gave him a long sentence. And they even talk about the Maryland conviction rate. A Maryland conviction of first-degree burglary cannot constitute a crime of violence, so said Judge James Wynn in your circuit court. And so the question I ask, are we at a point now where we are, you know, after Michelle Alexander's book and all the uproar in this country was made, and also we've seen many kind of very conservative Republican politicians saying we have to cut government spending. Is there a strange convergence happening at this moment between our judicial system and our legal system and our legislative system that's beginning to really wrestle with how we're adjudicating things and putting so many people of color in prison and question mandatory minimum, how that plays into it, and the Reagan area laws? I mean, it's very confusing, but where are we with all this right now? Andre, let me start with you.
Mark, I am as optimistic today as I have been in over two decades. There is, as you put it, a convergence of ideas. There is momentum. Of course, we have the Attorney General who's gotten on board and determined, as Sujit alluded to earlier, to do something about some of these harsh sentences. We have policymakers on the Hill and at the state level motivated in part by fiscal and financial considerations, but also by moral considerations. We have scholars and nonprofits like the Vera Institute, which just came out with a major study a couple of weeks ago. They looked at prosecution practices in Manhattan, the state prosecutor, and saw the disparate impact on African Americans from arrest and other aspects of the criminal justice system. So I think we're at a tipping point, frankly, an important tipping point where enlightened criminal justice policies are within reach, and I think it's a very positive development.
So let me ask Sujit and go to Mary Price here. Sujit Raman, I'll start with you on this question, picking up on what Andre Davis was just saying. And I know you can't talk policy, Sujit, but let me just throw this out anyway in a broader sense. I mean, do you think, is it time for us, given the numbers of people who are in prison in America, the largest percentage anywhere on the planet Earth, that we begin to really seriously evaluate how we both prosecute and charge people and maybe write laws to give judges more power, that we have to change the way we're doing things?
Well, Mark, let me follow up on something that Judge Davis said, which I think was absolutely right in the sense of momentum. You know, if we talk about momentum, I think it's important to look at some of the statistics that have come out over the last few years about violent crime and murder rates. Between 2003 and 2007, in the state of Maryland, you know, in our own home state, there were over 500 murders a year, which is an incredibly large number, incredibly impactful statistic when you think about the actual lives that are implicated when over, in a calendar year, you've got well over 500 murders a year. In the last 3 years, 2011 to 2013, we are under 400 murders a year in Maryland. Now, that is still, you know, a number that is far too large, but it shows sort of the idea of momentum, the fact that we have been having an impact on violent crime, not only in Maryland generally, but also in the city of Baltimore, where the statistics are generally positive. They've declined significantly over the last 10 years in the number of murders, even though we've had a slight uptick over the last couple of years. The point is that law enforcement has been empowered for a number of years now to try to attack what is a very serious social problem. And we have had momentum in terms of rolling back some of the tremendous community impact that this violent activity has. My concern is that, and perhaps I part ways a little bit with Judge Davis here, my concern is that as prosecutors, as law enforcement, we are starting to lose some of the tools that we've used in, I think, a very effective way in partnership with our state and local law enforcement partners to try to keep our community safe. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, this is a very interesting technical legal argument, but we need to keep in mind that there are real lives and real people, not only on the defendant side, which I certainly don't, deny that, but it's also the community. And part of our job on the law enforcement side is to make sure that people are safe. And the concern here is that the implications of a decision like DeKalb are that the most violent repeat offenders, the folks that we really focus our resources on, are not going to be serving the long mandatory terms of imprisonment that Congress, that the people have said should be serving them. So, again, I don't want to take up too much of your time, Mark, or the other panelists' time, but one of our concerns is that, as Judge Davis, I think, very appropriately said, there is momentum, there has been momentum, but my concern is that that momentum might be slowing, and you know, obviously we hope that there aren't serious impacts for the community.
And Scalia, I understand when I have three lawyers in the program, I expect kind of very long answers, and I do my best to keep it as tight as I can, but it's not always easy.
Why do you say that right before I begin to speak, however?
No, Mary Price, please, no, not at all. I want you to go here, and then I'm going to have a final thought from Andre Davis before we go, but go ahead, Mary.
Oh, no, I'll be very fast. Sorry.
That's all right.
I think that one of the things that motivates one of the real leaders in looking at mass incarceration and how we can limit the use of mandatory minimums, which is one of the key feeders of that, is the Department of Justice and its leader, Attorney General Eric Holder. And it is motivated in part by public safety concerns. And I absolutely agree that we need to keep our community safe and we need to use the tools, the legal tools in our box, you know, to do so. But here's the problem. One out of every $4 that the Department of Justice currently has goes to keep somebody locked up in federal prison. And if you include the Marshal Service, which moves them around and protects the courts, it's one out of every $3. Every single dollar that's spent keeping a person locked up is a dollar that's not being spent to, you know, help the U.S. Attorney's Office in Maryland do the job of detecting and preventing and prosecuting violent criminals. And this is one of the chief motivators, as Judge Davis pointed out, not the only one, but one of the chief motivators for the department sort of turnabout on the issue of, you know, who gets sentence for how long and for what offenses. And the Attorney General has said that we're locking up too many people for too long for too little reason. Half of the 216,000 people in federal prison are drug offenders. And a large number of them are not the kind of violent criminals that we are that afraid of. Now, I'm not saying people oughtn't to be punished, but we've got to take a different approach here because the dollars are slipping away. And in this day and age, we need to be providing the resources not just to the federal prosecutors to do their jobs, but to the state so that they can do the diversion programs and the work that they need to be to do to keep us safe.
And Andre, I'm going to bring it back in just because we only have like a minute left in this segment.
Sure.
But just to close this out, because I think the next level of discussion we have to have here on this program sometime in the coming month is where do we go from here? I mean, I know you've always said, I've known you for a long time, that you want bad guys off the street. And I've worked around bad guys enough to know that I want to see certain guys should not be on the street. But they're not the majority of people who get arrested.
That's exactly right. And I can assure Sujeet, and I don't need to, he knows this, the good lawyers in his office, when they stand up in front of a federal judge and around the country, They're not going to need a mandatory minimum statute in order to get a judge to send a really violent, dangerous person who poses a risk of harm to people in the community away for a very long time. They don't need these statutes. Judges will do that work in the basis of the advocacy brought by the prosecutors.
Well, this has been a really fascinating discussion, a very important one, and I appreciate the three of you taking the time. This has really been very clear, and I look forward to maybe in the next month when I get back as well. I'm going to take a little time, but to come back to wrestle with where we go from here and what our judicial systems look like, what we have to do to get the people who truly are dangerous off the street, but the millions of men and women who are arrested who are not truly dangerous, what do we do instead? And can we redevelop that kind of system?
I hope we can have that conversation.
Judge Andre Davis is Senior Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Sujit Raman is Appellate Chief for the Maryland U.S. Attorney's Office. Mary Price is the General Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums and Director of its Litigation Project. Thank you three so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
We can take a brief break and go out to Soul to Soul. Hit number one in the UK charts this day with Keep On Moving. We're going to come back and talk about this first anniversary of the release of George Zimmerman, acquittal of George Zimmerman, what that means. Stay with us. We'll be right back.